Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Justine Toe. Well, it's been 97 years since the end of World War I and 70 years since the end of World War II. This Life and Faith, we're marking Remembrance Day, a day dedicated to the men and women who've suffered or died in wars. But today, our focus is a bit different. We're going to be thinking about Australian Army chaplains who provided spiritual and practical support, humour and cheer, and also consolation to countless soldiers in all major conflicts where Australia has sent troops. To talk about this, I'm joined by Michael Gladwin. He's a lecturer in history in the School of Theology at Charles Sturt University. His book on the topic, Captains of the Soul, A History of Australia's Army Chaplains, recently won the Australian Christian Book of the Year. And he joins us on the phone from Canberra. Michael, thank you for speaking with us. Captains of the Soul. It's quite an evocative title, and there's quite an interesting story that lies behind it. Can you share it with us?
Well, that title comes from the story of a Second World War chaplain who served in the Australian Army. And he found himself in late 1941 in Malaya with the 8th Division of the Australian Army. The Allies fought bravely, but they were pushed back by the much greater force of the Japanese Imperial Army. Cunningham and several thousand other Australians went into captivity, and they found themselves in the most brutal of the Japanese prisoner of war camps, which were on the Burma-Thai Railway. Cunningham was treated just as badly as others. There are accounts of him being tortured in bamboo cages, just like other prisoners, and he faced his share of beatings and privation. The Japanese weren't sure exactly what he was because they noticed that the soldiers paid him great respect. There was an air of authority that he exuded among the troops, but there was no equivalent of a chaplain in the Japanese Imperial Army. Eventually, they twigged that this was some kind of spiritual leader. He was given, after a while, an armband, and it had Japanese kanji characters on it, but, of course, not knowing Japanese, and no one else around him knew Japanese, he didn't know what this said. So he wore this armband and was commanded to wear it for the next 3 years. But he noticed he was treated with greater respect by the Japanese soldiers from that point. Well, he survived, unlike many other Australians. He came back to Australia, and one of the first things he did was to get this armband, which he kept, to get it translated. And it translated as Captain of the Souls of Men. And in many ways, I thought this was a wonderfully evocative phrase of the dual role that chaplains have played in the Australian Defence Forces. Their initial rank is captain, so they have a role within the actual army. They're just as much a part of the army as other soldiers, but they're also moral and spiritual leaders sent by the church they're representing.
We don't normally think about, you know, spiritual matters having anything to do with the army. And yet, from your book, it seems that chaplains are really valued by soldiers. Can you tell us more about how essential they're seen to military life?
Well, chaplains have long been seen as central to military life, and that goes right back to ancient times when there were religious functionaries within armies when they went into battle. So chaplains have always been part of the army institution. There's been no question of their place. And it makes sense in a way because more than most occupations, soldiers are facing issues of life and death. There's the potential for many to lose their lives, so they hit existential bedrock, perhaps more quickly than most other professions would. And so it's been recognized that the spiritual element, as well as the moral element, a need for a transcendent moral code by which to direct soldiers' morality, whether it's their actions within war, for example, not harming prisoners of war, that moral compass has been recognized as important, as well as a spiritual role.
And what do chaplains end up doing? I mean, I think most of us would assume that, you know, they're running some sort of religious services as needed and providing that kind of pastoral care and spiritual support to people. But it did strike me when reading your book that they were doing all sorts of other things as well, like, becoming an informal postal service for the soldiers. They were even stretcher bearers as well.
That's right. Their role, it was quite expansive. And it was really up to them to carve out their role when they began in the First World War. They, as you said, they acted as stretcher bearers. They were behind the lines providing entertainment for troops, wholesome recreation to keep young soldiers out of the brothels and taverns as much as they could, although they were not often successful in that attempt. They were also providing a bridge between the world back home. So they were writing to families, making sure, as you've said, the mail got back, writing to loved ones whose or families whose loved ones had been wounded or killed. So they were that important connection point as well. There's a really practical role as social welfare officers. In some ways, they're informal counselors and psychologists. And it's not until the 1960s that you get professional psychologists and social workers in the army. So really, that role is played by chaplains up to the 1960s. And they're still part of what's called that care chain of command. But it's all left to the chaplain before that point. And but chaplains are still different because they, unlike psychologists and social workers, actually live and sweat and sometimes die and are wounded on the front lines with soldiers.
And there are a couple of big personalities that you talk about through the book. There's William Fighting Mac McKenzie. He sounds very manly. He was a chaplain in World War One. Why don't you tell us about him?
Well, Fighting McKenzie is probably the most famous chaplain, especially from World War One. He was a larger-than-life character, a Salvation Army officer. He'd cut his teeth in ministry in the slums around Newcastle. He was a fiery evangelist who was used to outdoor preaching, to really working with the rougher areas of the working class. He was a man's man as well. He was quite an extraordinary boxer by all accounts. And so he sort of garnered respect in that sense of a kind of a muscular Christianity that was quite important from the late 19th through the 20th century, because there were concerns among churches that there were few men in the pews, there were many more women. So that muscular tradition of Christianity he embodied. But he's also noted for his great gentleness, pastoral care of soldiers, his absolute commitment to the soldiers he was serving. And it was with them right through from Gallipoli through to the Western Front. And there was immense affection and respect. It was said when he returned to Australia, he came back basically with a nervous breakdown after 4 years of that intense experience. Came back and he was one of the most popular people in Australia. It was said that the two people diggers most wanted to meet were Billy Hughes, the Prime Minister, and Fighting Mac McKenzie.
If you've just joined us on Life and Faith, this Remembrance Day, we're talking with Michael Gladwin about the role of chaplains in the Australian Army. But before we get back to that interview, here's a description by Kenneth Henderson, an Anglican chaplain from World War One. In it, he talks about how he went about comforting wounded soldiers.
I do all I can to help promote inner tranquility and fortitude, so I proceed as quietly as possible about my father's business. A man shaken by shock and pain of his wounds needs strength of will and peace of mind above all. He knows not how severe his injuries are. Wide-eyed, he faces eternity and gropes in the loneliness of pain and shock for sympathy and confidence. He is not to be questioned or worried, but to be reassured in his great loneliness and darkness that the eternal arms of God's love and mercy are about him, and help to feel the grip of Christ's pierced hands, the Christ who has been through it all himself.
When it comes to the way that chaplains speak of spiritual things and the nature of the transcendent, the dignity of life, this is no small challenge in the midst of war. So how did chaplains navigate that task?
Well, they navigated in different ways, and in some ways it depended on their shade of Christianity, their emphasis. For example, a Roman Catholic chaplain would be concerned to get the sacraments to a soldier, because that they believe the presence of Christ and the presence of God comes through the sacraments, that soldiers will meet God in that way. And so, for example, a dying soldier, it was important for a Roman Catholic chaplain to pray final unction, which are the prayers of preparation for those who are dying. For an Anglican chaplain like Henderson, whose writing you read out there, there was a concern also to connect these men to the transcendent, to a spiritual hope, to eternal life. and to God ultimately. And so it was often through prayer that he would try to do that. He would sit as a ministry of presence with that soldier, but also pray with them and try to offer them consolation. There were chaplains who were more direct, who tried to get soldiers, dying soldiers, to pray to God, to make a direct response to God, particularly evangelicals who have an emphasis on conversion and a need for definite commitment. Certainly it was to try and help them to find a larger hope. And it was a hope that these chaplains themselves had found, often as young men, before they'd gone into the ministry. They'd had an encounter with the transcendent, with God, and they were trying to help these soldiers connect as well. But it was, as you say, it was no small challenge.
On that point, chaplains themselves would have grappled with big theological questions about the nature of evil, suffering, and so on. So how did they think about war theologically? I mean, because they were in the thick of it.
That's right. This was no armchair theologizing or philosophizing. These were matters of life and death, literally. As you say, the chaplains had done those moral and theological sums before they'd gone, and they wouldn't have joined the army as chaplains had they not done them. In many cases, you find snippets of conversation with soldiers, say in the First World War, and Henderson was a very articulate thinker and conversationalist with these young soldiers. And he recounts these sorts of conversations about bigger theological issues. For example, one soldier asked him, you know, did God orchestrate this war? You know, this question of divine sovereignty and free will. And he responded with a classic free will defense, the sort of defense that Christian theologians since the time of Augustine have used in relation to war, which basically argues that we have free will, we have free agents, and it's because of our humanity's choice to depart from God's ways, to pursue selfishness, to pursue power, and not walk in the ways that we were designed to walk. That's where that's why we've got in this situation of war. It's an extreme situation. So God is not culpable in a sense because of free will.
You mentioned that nowadays the chaplain will work as part of a broader team of, you know, psychologists and social workers. How else has the role of the army chaplain changed today compared to that World War I chaplain, let's say?
In many ways, the role has stayed the same. It's that spiritual role, you know, through religious instruction, through burial, through baptism, through also working with families. I haven't mentioned that chaplains have had an intimate role behind the lines as social workers within families. So there's that social welfare role, both on the front line and behind the lines. Those roles have all continued right through. Chaplains did change some of their roles, particularly after the First World War, where instead of organizing entertainments and taking up a lot of time in doing that, that was taken over by auxiliaries like the YMCA. Another role that has changed slightly over time has been in burial. Chaplains had the unenviable task of battlefield burials in the wars up to the Vietnam War. And I mean, it was a brutal job because sometimes it meant literally collecting pieces of Australian soldiers. The devastating impact of modern warfare they saw firsthand, and some had nervous breakdowns from doing these sorts of jobs, or what we might today call post-traumatic stress.
And I didn't know this as well, but it was chaplains who first drove commemorative efforts like Anzac Day.
That's right. Chaplain Garland was a First World War chaplain who basically created the whole form of the Anzac Day services. It was another chaplain, Arthur White, who helped give shape to the Dawn service. And that was really drawn out of both of their high Anglican traditions. They used the ritual and the imagery of the Anglican liturgy, of the prayer book, and they shaped that for a national service that would have wide appeal to all Australians. Anzac Day, in particular, has always incorporated chaplains. They play a crucial role, and that has continued, even though since the 1960s and 70s, there's been a decline in Australians' commitment to institutional churches in particular. You know, there might be believing, but there's less belonging. That importance of chaplains at Anzac Day hasn't changed, and within the services, there's no question that chaplains should be intimately involved.
Well, it's a fascinating read, your book, Captains of the Soul, and it's also a very interesting glimpse into Australia's history, particularly as it concerns its spiritual history, filtered through the institution of the army. Thank you very much for sharing your research with us, Michael.
Thanks, Justine. Good to talk to you.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Thanks for your company. See you next time.